Start the show.
For Thursday, March 15th, 2018. Welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. Hello and welcome, everyone. We are actually recording this one day before you're listening to it. So for us, it is Pi Day.
Yay. Pi Day.
3.14159265 something.
Wow.
Oh, that's still pretty good. It's Pi Day for some.
Oh.
For others, it's July 22nd.
What?
Because 22 divided by 7 is another representation of
You mean for some other people, so other Pi people. Day, it's July. Oh, I've never heard of that before.
Yeah.
Which Pi Day do you subscribe to?
So if you live in Europe where the notation is 22.7, there you go.
Okay.
I'd subscribe to the original Pi Day.
March 14th.
Yeah.
And what do you do something special at 159?
I used to go to the Exploratorium, and they have a big Pi Day celebration out in front of their museum. They have a Pi Day walk, and you finish by actually eating pie together.
Nah.
Started by a
savory or sweet?
I'm a very sweet pie guy.
Okay.
It was started by just one of those Exploratorium characters that's been there forever, and everyone has a digit of pie, and it's a lot of fun.
Well, something that's a little bittersweet, more sad actually, is our biggest news story this week. Just yesterday, we had the passing of Stephen Hawking.
Yeah, I mean, I think the news broke probably late last night.
It was Pi Day where
Tuesday.
He passed.
It was Pi Day when the announcement got to us. I think he passed sometime on Tuesday. It was just sort of a stunning finding, and the outpouring was pretty immediate. Even though like there was so much other news happening, it sort of just cut through like a knife. All the outpouring of love and affection for him, that I think a lot of what I saw relates back to people, especially people our age, reading A Brief History of in Time.
For me, it was Universe in a Nutshell.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was a little younger.
I was Brief History of Time on audio tape.
Oh, on audio tape.
Yeah, I love
it. I read it when I think I was 12, maybe I was 11, something like that. And it was the first time I remember being exposed to that world of physics. Mm-hmm. Like, the only place you had ever heard of black holes before then was just science fiction.
Yeah.
And to hear about it from somebody that had done so much work on theorizing black holes in a way that was really easy to understand was pretty revolutionary. What about you? What do you remember from Brief History? Or I don't think I've even watched... what's it?
It was a book.
It was a book.
Universe in a Nutshell. Yeah, it was a simple, easier to comprehend, and it's one of those things where he was as much a pop culture icon as he was a massive figure in his field.
Later in life, for sure. Yeah. Early in his life, I mean, he was just straight up a scientist. Like some of his work on black holes, like first, you know, just basically coming up with this idea of that event horizons are they are the size they are, and that radiation is emitted from black holes. That theory was pretty earth shattering at the time, and to have it be born true, and then have black holes actually can evaporate because of Hawking radiation. That's sort of an amazing consequence, and his work on quantum mechanics from there. Was really stunning and sort of shattered a lot of barriers that exist in the field. But he was often wrong, too. But that's just part of being who he was.
And his work was ongoing. It wasn't like
he hasn't done much like on work in the last like 10, 15 years, at least on theoretical work that I was aware of. But there was quite a bit of work, you know, basically through his 50s and 60s.
It's probably some irony in the fact that he used a voice synthesizer, and yet he was also a great communicator. You know, that's one of the things about the book, A Brief History of Time, that stood out to me was that I could even understand anything that he was talking about. And he really helped me to get into black holes in a way that I never thought I would.
you know, there's a lot of things that I loved about him too. He famously made bets with other scientists about, you know, a wide range of items. Like he bet that the Higgs boson didn't exist with Peter Higgs, and obviously he announced that he had lost that bet back in 2012. So he wasn't shy about making those kinds of bets and making his thoughts known on what existed out there. I just think his work on sort of the early universe around inflation, which is still an area that eludes us in a lot of ways, that moment right after the Big Bang happened, how did the universe accelerate so much, so rapidly, and that acceleration continues today? That's something we just don't understand, even to this day. So I think that's sort of a fascinating area that he really helped popularize. And it didn't matter if he was right or wrong. I just like that sort of spirit that he had, was like, oh, I'll bet you.
You mentioned the pop culture.
Yep.
I went out a little forlorn last night, and I told my wife and son that he had died. And my son, my 11-year-old son, said, who's Stephen Hawking? And I said, well, I was able to tell him, do you remember that Star Trek episode where Data is playing poker against Einstein and two other scientists?
And Newton.
Well, Einstein, Newton.
He was one of them.
He's the only character, I think, that ever played himself.
That's right. The only person in history who played himself in Star Trek. And he was, in Simpsons, Futurama.
Yeah. Simpsons, Futurama. There's
a Simpsons action figure of Stephen Hawking, which I think is pretty neat.
My favorite weird story about Stephen Hawking is, like, I think in 2009, he threw a party. He had announced it earlier that he was going to host a party for time travelers.
Yes.
And he did not send time travelers. He didn't send any invites out.
Until after the fact.
But he basically was very clear afterwards that there was going to be this party on this date.
Oh, that's great.
And he had poured champagne. There was hors d'oeuvres set out. There's a video of him at his house, like, hosting this party.
But no one showed up.
He actually was pretty irreverent. I met him once.
Wow.
In passing. And I was sort of, like, overly prepared to ask, like, a really serious physics question.
Yeah.
And he was making jokes with people.
Mm.
And he was sort of famous for almost being, like, borderline practical joker with people around him. He had a wry sensibility about him. At least later in life, that really came through, and I think that's shown through with the fact that he went on The Simpsons and Futurama and all these other things.
What is that like, having any kind of conversation with him when there's a delay for him to formulate his sentence?
Well, he super late in life, he had to formulate a lot of those conversations ahead of time and, like, pre-program them, so like there wasn't this, like, back and forth. But a tested user was telling me last night he went to a talk of his at Zellerbach Hall in Berkeley, and there was a Q&A, and somebody had asked him if he believed in God, and there was this really long pause.
Wow.
Until it said no, and then there was another big pause because he actually had written, like, basically noted out this long answer, but it just said no. And so the whole theater was left there hanging on a no to that answer for a little while. So, I mean, it's sort of, like, stilted like that, but he had sort of a small set of helpers that would help him communicate much later in life, too. Did you watch The Theory of Everything?
Oh, yeah. I really enjoyed it.
I didn't see it, but
it's a really great
now
movie.
I want to.
I mean, his relationship with his wife definitely went through ups and downs, which I think are sort of told in that movie. But I think that's a brilliant, like, peek into Stephen Hawking the person. Which is not easy to see.
By the way, he did make it to Pi Day because it was the 14th in England.
Yes.
By the time he passed.
That's great, didn't it?
So I kind of feel like I might be thinking about this every Pi Day now.
Yeah. I think we'd be remiss without saying he also was a champion for people with different disabilities. He was spokesman for Paralympics. He couldn't do the ALS challenge himself, but his kids did it on his behalf, which is great to know, given his condition. So, Stephen Hawking, we'll never forget you.
culture.
How's your guys' past weekend? You guys do anything fun?
Oh my. I don't know, man.
It was Ira's first baseball game.
Ah. Very cool. I think I saw a video you posted of him hitting a single.
Does not. Yeah, well, I mean, it was more like a double.
Oh, wow.
He just stopped at first. Decided that was not enough.
That's got to be a good feeling.
For him, me, I'm like, where does he get that? Not me.
Yeah. I was over in Vegas. March Madness is happening, and went over to the T-Mobile Arena and watched some basketball games. A lot of fun. Had some good food. But I also did something at the MGM Grand. I'm going to get it out of the way before we get to the VR minute. Did the zero latency thing.
Do tell.
Zero latency is a location-based VR, I guess, service.
So it's like the Void.
Yeah, and then I think more places. Vegas is one of them. I think they have one in London, I want to say. Not as elaborate as the Void in terms of what you can interact with. But really easy to get into multiplayer VR. We had 8 people, 5 friends and 3 randos, and they had a room that was, they said 2,000 square feet. To me, it looked about 30 feet wide by 65 feet long. And it was a 30-minute VR game.
That's long.
Which felt long, especially when it's a wireless experience. So you're wearing a backpack that, you know, is maybe 15, 20 pounds. And wearing goggles that are not the most comfortable. They're using OSVR headsets. Mm. And holding a pretty heavy, prop, space rifle. So I've definitely felt physically exhausted afterward. Very sweaty.
What was the structure of the room?
The room, it's funny, we'll have some photos and some video you'll see in this week's episode of Projections, but they had grid lines on the ground to make it look like the holodeck. And I think it was both to make it look like the holodeck and also so that the technicians running the room could physically move people if they were out of place, if they had somehow stepped out of bounds or something. But the room was long. It was twice as long, more than twice as long as it was wide, which meant that the scenarios that played out were like more stand your ground type scenarios where you're like defending against incoming hordes of aliens or zombies. And after you defeat a wave, then they would have you move to the next checkpoint. So you move down one corridor, which means you walk down the other side of the room and then stand in these circles. And in the circles, when everyone's in their circle, then the next sequence activates, and then you turn around and you basically shoot the other direction.
Okay, so there's nothing in the room.
It's a completely empty.
Empty room.
Completely empty. Yeah.
Okay.
That feels like a missed opportunity.
I think it's a lot based on what they had programmed in the experience and also how easy it would be for them to franchise this out, because all they need is an empty space that they can track.
Yeah.
And
what was their tracking solution?
They had these, both the headsets had extra tracking markers that were like these IR balls, light balls, golf ball size. Mm-hmm.
So some sort of optical thing on the ceiling?
Yeah, it wasn't perfect tracking, some misalignment, definitely for sure. Hmm. But very clever in how they would do calibration and make it easy for newcomers, because this whole experience is designed for people who probably have never used VR and needs to be a good experience for them. It needs to be not nauseating. So you'd input your name on a computer, you type in your height and your gender, and then when you first get into the game, you put on your headset, you pick up, you see a rifle, a generic rifle on the ground, you pick up the rifle, and then they basically bind that rifle to you because they know how close you are, your backpack is to it.
Okay.
And then they say, oh, walk to the circle with your name on top of it, and you walk to like this floating circle, and then that binds your backpack to your character name that you've inputted into a tablet beforehand.
That's a good idea.
I can't tell if you like this or not yet.
I thought it was fun. I like that it was the two things I really liked about it was how long it was, the 30-minute experience, which felt like a long time, especially with the physical rifle I was holding. And the multiplayer aspect. I mean, you're never running around, right? Like you're just kind of stationary, standing in the spot that you choose with your back to another player. But you have voice comms with microphones and headphones, and so everyone yelling and shouting and getting really excited for whatever is coming. That part was a lot of fun.
And you can see their avatars.
Yeah,
full body.
Full body, not eye-cade very well. you know, sliding bodies, floating arms.
You didn't have trackers on your feet.
No, no trackers on feet or arms.
Got it.
Just the rifles. Yeah.
I'm going to Vegas on Friday, so.
I think it's worth it. It's like $50. I think if it's.
That's not that much for a half hour.
I mean, for Vegas, especially. Everything's so expensive there. If you have friends who have not done VR and you haven't done VR, I think it's a really fun way to get them.
I don't think they have. I should just go trash them.
Yeah. Yeah. You can get some pretty high score.
You did all right.
I did pretty good. Yeah. Use the rail gun.
Okay.
That gives you a really good score. None of us were at South by Southwest, which was going on also last week, but there were a couple of interesting things that I think we would have wished we were there for.
Mm.
One of which was the premiere, the first public premiere of Ready Player One.
Hot dog.
The movie comes out for everyone in 2 weeks or so.
Yeah, I'm seeing it that Friday.
And
we're going to the same screening.
Oh, did you get a ticket?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Lucky ducks.
You're traveling.
Yeah, I'm traveling. The reviews are out.
There's two things of note from the initial screening. One, the screening broke.
Oh, did it? I didn't read
that. Yeah, it had a technical difficulty in the middle.
No.
And like basically,
how embarrassing.
It paused. It got stuck.
I wonder if people thought that was part of the movie.
It's so postmodern.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Oasis, stuck. And the reviews are mostly positive.
Yeah, it's a fresh tomato.
Yeah.
And like, it's a fresh tomato.
Question mark.
It's a high percentage of higher than 50% approval, but the average critical score is right in the middle.
What I got garnered from it, and you know, if you don't want to hear this, just stop listening for a second. It's not any spoilers. Is that the people that went in with low expectations were pleasantly surprised, and people that didn't like Ready Player One, the book, did not like the movie.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, interesting. Because I haven't seen anybody say, I love the book and I love the movie. So I figured most people were maybe just going in fresh. Or
who do you know that said they love the book, period?
What are you talking about?
That wants to watch the movie.
Well, Micah, for instance.
Didn't he say he loved the movie?
Yeah. Yeah. So, are you asking who liked the book but didn't like the movie?
Yeah.
No, I haven't seen that.
So anyone who liked the book probably like the movie.
Well, what I haven't seen, based on our small sample, with the exception of Mike, is I haven't seen I Love the Book and I Love the Movie. And so I've taken that to mean it's not as good as the book.
Wow.
But it's a good movie.
I've seen the opposite. I've seen people say, well, the book was not that great, but the movie salvages it and does something better than the book.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I've heard that it does some different things. Like there are some much more modern references.
Oh, of course. They have to update the references. And a lot of the book, you know, it plays out in your head. They have to do a lot of telling, not showing. In the movie, you know, with visuals, you can just show and not have to have a ton of exposition.
I think the hard place, if you really like the book, is that the book is divisive in and of itself. There's a lot of people that really didn't care for it.
Yep.
Felt like it was nostalgia porn or whatever. Norm might be one of those people.
I like the IO9 review.
Yeah, the IO9 review.
Who called the movie akin to a rude orgy participant.
Yeah.
The movie is a rude orgy participant that rubs itself against you, trying to get you excited, but you just don't want it to be near you.
Okay.
I don't think that person liked the book.
I don't think he liked the movie.
Yeah. I think I wouldn't be surprised if the movie is divisive, just as the book was.
Does this make you more or less excited for the premiere?
Oh, I have been assuming the movie's going to be bad based on the trailers and posters. And just because I like the book so much, I'm not likely to like the movie as much.
Have we flipped 180 on the posters?
So the fact that people are coming out of this saying it's all right, I feel like I'm in good shape. I feel like my enthusiasm is where it should be. And if it's a return to Jurassic Park Spielberg, and I can put my love for the book aside and just enjoy the film.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
I'm
going to
be in good shape.
What do you mean a return to Jurassic Park Spielberg? Spielberg's made plenty of amazing films since Jurassic Park. Are you talking about a type of film
a roller coaster ride. You know, something that's pure spectacle and it has that Spielberg DNA of storytelling.
I feel like it's going to be more Jurassic Park 2 than Jurassic Park 1.
Ouch. Boy, you are bitter.
That was mean.
I mean, you're talking about like just spectacle for the sake of spectacle. You're bringing your kid there. What do you think? What do you hope that he gets out of it as someone who is growing up with modern video games?
I don't know, man.
If there's no Minecraft reference, is Pixels a better movie for him?
You know, I haven't given this much thought, but now that you ask, I hope he doesn't like it.
Wow, because he won't appreciate it.
Because, no, he loves the book. It's his favorite book.
Whoa.
So I hope he goes in, and this is the first movie that he doesn't love. Like, kids love movies. Like, they're just not critical about stuff. Mm. So I hope that this is his first
Have you shown him Pixels?
No, I haven't.
What about Wreck-It Ralph?
What's wrong with Wreck-It Ralph?
Nothing's wrong with Wreck-It Ralph. Okay. I'm talking about movies that feed on some nostalgia for you know, video games and the 80s.
Well, that's irrelevant. Like, he'll like that or not. Like, actually, his favorite band right now is Bon Jovi. So he's in the
real full.
He's in
80s.
The right zone.
How old is
right.
this kid?
He's
is
11.
He like 35? Hey, one last question. Over and under, over under on the number of bullet references in the movie. Three?
Oh, wow.
I'm going with zero.
I think I'll go with the under for three.
Okay.
Let's go one. Well, what do we think of opening weekend?
Do you think this is going to respond to it? Underperform.
Wow.
I don't know. It depends what else is out. I mean, it's Spielberg. You know, whether or not like it compares to the book.
$40 million.
It's still going to be hopefully a blast, like a
that
joyride.
Qualifies as underperform.
Yeah. That's my guess. 42 million. 42.1.
I'll go with 100 million.
What?
Yeah.
Wow. You just, sir.
Oh, my God.
If we're playing Price is Right rules, you're in trouble.
Well, I would have gone 45 million if I was playing Price is Right rules.
No.
You don't think 100 million?
No, no way. No wow. way. Right. No way. Right. I'm ready to be wrong here, but right. I'm pretty confident it's not going to do 100 million. Yeah. I'm sticking to it. Let's see what you guys think out there. All right. Speaking of movies that are a little divisive, and even within this room, we have the digital release and the Blu-ray upcoming release of The Last Jedi this month.
That's right.
You guys haven't seen it yet since theaters? since theaters?
We did
right?
see it, yeah, but not right. since
You guys
the
looking
theaters.
Forward to rewatching it or not so much?
Not at all. But
wow.
Interestingly, Rian Johnson tweeted about a special feature that's a bit hidden. And I would watch this.
Oh, so what would you watch?
This is the John Williams only soundtrack to the film. So it gets rid of all of the sound effects, all the dialogue, and it's just the Williams score.
So it's like a silent film.
That's what he compares it to.
Would you watch it in black and white?
And he like turned the color all the way down.
Yeah, with some film grain effects. Scratchy.
He said that he really wanted to include this feature, and so they struggled with how to do it, and they didn't have the room on the Blu-ray. You can't do this on a lot of streaming
why
networks.
Why do they have the room on the Blu-ray?
You know, I'm not going to argue with Rian Johnson and Disney about that. So Disney suggested this solution, which is you need the, what do they call it, the Watch Anywhere app? It's Disney's app.
Oh, you get like a code for a digital download of
yeah.
it?
Yeah. So anything you buy on iTunes or elsewhere, if you plug it into this app, It's like you can watch things from many services, and they propagate over the
sure.
other services. And this will unlock that feature.
So you can't unlock, you choose typically which service you want to unlock your digital copy.
Right.
With iTunes or whatever proprietary service, Ultraviolet, whatever. And so you have to choose Disney's service if you want to get this cut of
well,
the film.
I don't know if that's the case. Like in my experience, the Watch Anywhere app actually does something. It's good. It actually okay. unlocks it on other services.
Oh, okay.
So that if you get it on Google, it's unlocked elsewhere.
Oh, okay.
Or at least it's unlocked on this app as well, mm-hmm. and then you can AirPlay it or something like that. But so yeah, I mean that's kind of interesting. I think soundtracks, especially orchestral ones, go in notice subliminally, and to be able to focus on it.
I would go one step further. I want more films to do this, to give me the score-only version. Mm. I would like, I mean, given how video files, media files are distributed today, these are just audio tracks, which I understand they're not small, because we're talking about 5.1 and high bit rate, but they're not as big as the video files themselves. So I would love a score-only track. I would like a effects-only, a Foley-only track.
Yeah.
That'd be just to appreciate the sound effects.
Wilhelm
you know?
Scream.
I mean, just like space battles and like there's a lot if you talk about sound editing, like I want to hear these things and I would like the ability to remix and then combine. I want the score and the sound effects, but no dialogue.
So you can make your own cut?
So you can make your own
just
cut.
Just give yourself a second screen app like on your iPad where with knobs and you
yes.
can like fade in
you
what
can,
you want.
You can be a sound mixer.
That's actually really cool.
Right?
Yeah.
You know. Disney is not going to be down with that.
I know Disney's not going to be, but that'd be really cool. And then for families to watch along, and you can just turn down the dialogue, and you can be BB-8, kid, right? You just do the sound effects of BB-8. Let's watch along the movies. Mm-hmm. You know,
here's a lighter. You be BB-8.
You're going to be a great dad.
You could be Kylo Ren,
kid.
kid, generic kid. Yeah. Well, I'm excited. I don't know if the Blu-ray is 4K HDR, but if it is, I'll have to pick that up, I think.
Well, the Blu-ray is not going to be out first. It's streaming only at first.
I know. Yeah. They always do that right now. A couple other things in pop culture. Fantastic Beasts, the Crimes of Grindelwald.
Yeah, the trailer's out.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Trailer looks good.
People are very excited for Jude Law.
With one exception.
Uh-oh. We've got Harry Potter. Nitpicking here?
Nitpicking. Can't apparate inside of Hogwarts. Mm. What was that Janet about?
Janet said the exact same thing. It's a lot of head shaking going on and watching that trailer.
What was that about?
Yeah.
I actually like Jude Law as Dumbledore.
Explain what that means.
You can't, the magicians in Harry Potter can transport themselves, and it's called apparition. And there's some charm on the school of Hogwarts that prevents it, and Hermione Granger says it constantly throughout the book series, that everyone knows you can't apparate.
Teleporting inside Hogwarts is no go.
And in one of the trailer scenes, we see people apparate right out in front of
who put the
Hogwarts.
Charms on?
I don't know.
Well, maybe these people put the charm on, and maybe this is
backwards in time. So
retconning.
That's it. Maybe that's happening in the trailer just for people like you.
And maybe it is the reason the charm was put on because of things that happen in this movie. It's written by J.K. Rowling, so she can do whatever she wants.
Yes, she can do whatever.
Deal with it, fans. She makes the canon.
I would just love, like, in the middle of the cut, it just cuts to a picture of her sliding the sunglasses on her face.
deal with it.
She can't make Harry and Hermione get together, unfortunately.
Well, because she's already written something else.
I know.
You can write whatever fan fiction you want.
No, she regrets that.
What?
Yeah, she says that is one of her great regrets, is she should have had those two get together.
At some point.
At the end of the story.
Oh, really?
Instead of Ron and Hermione.
That's a big change.
Yeah, well, she...
I don't like that at all.
You don't? Whoa. Really?
Oh, but this is... No. I don't think we've ever talked about Harry Potter as much.
That is the great satisfaction. That would be the fulfillment of the Erst that was there for seven books.
No, because I think that devalues Hermione's point in the books.
Oh, do tell.
Oh, because then, like, part of what her whole story is to get together with Harry Potter.
Uh-huh.
That devalues her character.
But she got with Ron, then that's fine?
Yeah, but it's Ron. And
right.
He's kind of a loser.
Weasley.
Yeah, he's such a Weasley.
These names are so imaginative. Yeah, Slytherin. Oh, no, you can't, no, nothing's gonna, good's gonna ever come of that kid.
What is it, carpal tongue?
I don't know.
No, it's like, you speak snake? No, we've lost it now.
Parcel tongue.
Parcel tongue, that's it, yeah.
All right, a little bit change of pace. If you're not into reading books or watching the movies, maybe you can listen to audiobooks. This is something interesting. Marvel has started releasing a new podcast series, not exactly true crime, but a fictional crime podcast series in the world of the X-Men universe. It's called Wolverine: The Long Night, and the reviews have been quite good.
Have you listened to it?
I have not yet. I queued up for a trip I'm doing this coming weekend, so I'm going to listen to it this weekend.
How do you feel about this sort of, like, fictional podcasts are great.
Let's just call it an audiobook.
Okay.
Right? Wait, it's an audiobook.
Is it an official Marvel thing?
It's an official Marvel thing.
And it's free?
I'm not exactly sure.
How do you get it? You can get it through streaming services?
I think it's on Stitcher. So, 10 episode, and I guess the reason it's called a podcast is because it is free. It's not like you buy an audiobook. But the way the podcast format allows for it to be of a certain length and allows to be serialized, you know, chapters of a book, it's a 10-part series.
Huh.
In much the way that, you know, S-Town was very much a novel structure. This is like a book.
So apparently Stitcher is a streaming service. It costs $5 a month after the free trial.
Right.
Oh, for a premium. Yeah. Are they going to do voices then? Like different characters?
I'm
different
curious
voices?
About that. Yeah. Like, would you prefer to be like a teleplay where it's different voice actors?
It is. It's different actors doing the voices.
Oh, wow.
So it is like a teleplay. I like.
Then I'm in.
Okay. So you like that more than the
if
single
it's a single,
reader.
Single narrator. Does, yeah. Does different kitschy voices, that doesn't make sense to me. Mm. Then it's somebody reading a comic book to you, which doesn't sound fun.
I'm curious about like how exposition, because in book form you have to have a ton of exposition, how that works in a comic book universe where there is basically very little exposition because it's just word bubbles and panels.
Unless you're Ta-Nehisi Coates, because that was a pretty wordy book.
Yes. You see a lot of, like, exposition in comic books is the frame rectangular boxes on the corner of panels that lay out,
yeah,
meanwhile, you know, ellipses. I'm curious about it. Wolverine the Long Night is its name, and it's available on Stitcher.
I'll check it out.
And then going back to South by Southwest.
Oh, poor Norm. You got shut down on Still Untitled with your excitement about Westworld.
I was so excited about this.
Wait a minute. Other people don't like Westworld?
No. Will and Adam were not enthused about this experience I want to describe.
Okay.
So I'm going to lay it on you guys and see how excited you guys are, both of you who have been joined me in immersive theater experiences. Back in New York Comic Con, I talked about how I did that Westworld mini experience where they did like an interview, they put you as a guest, and they had, you know, actors playing hosts, and then had this very small bar area where you got served several drinks with bartenders who also played hosts and a few actors in there.
You were invited by a listener.
Yes, Dawn.
Good time.
Yeah. Totally great time. Great like little activation they did in New York Comic Con. Well, they took that idea and really blew it out for South By. And they found a ghost town outside of Austin and set dressed it up with production design and bussed people from South by Southwest to this area where they spent like 3 hours in an immersive theater experience set up like Westworld. So they had, I think, almost 100 actors memorize a script of 400 pages. And it was Sweetwater. They had bars, they had the saloon, they had gunslingers, they had teases to the world behind the scenes. Mm. So attendees could peek, you know, behind the curtain, pull back the curtain and see like Delos employees working on, you know, repairing robots or sculpting the next generation robots. There was an actual maze that the attendees could go through, and they even had, as a tease, in the outskirts of Sweetwater, a samurai just wandering.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And they did it.
That's one of the other worlds in the original film.
They also teased at the end of the season one, Shogun World. So, and then they had a full, like, climactic scene play out where there was a big a shootout in the middle of town. And then two actors. There's some great YouTube videos of people who filmed it.
I think Simone went, right?
I don't know if she went to the Westworld one.
I think, well.
Maybe she did.
Maybe.
She was at South By. I'm super envious of this.
Will brought up one point on Still Untitled that I think is worth discussing, is that given what Westworld is about, interacting with real actors in that environment, it's got to be uncomfortable.
Well, it's the same as, like, you know, speakeasy experience that we did. Now, in the speakeasy, the people are playing real people. They're not playing robots that you're supposed to have your way with. So I think some of the written reviews I read of the South by Southwest experience said that it was more of a psychological experiment because it was more about how far would you go in interaction with these actors when they're supposed to be playing these subservient robots.
I think you know more about the rules of an experience like this than most people do. You had more experience with it.
Mm-hmm.
At the speakeasy, you're not supposed to engage with the actors.
Mm-hmm.
You're supposed to wait for them to come to you, and
right,
if they engage you, then you can have a back and forth with them
in
character.
Yes.
But that's not what it's like in Westworld, so I'm not sure people had that assumption.
Yeah, and here people were encouraged to engage, and you read about all the different script options.
So there was a lot of improv.
A lot. I mean, I think they had a lot of, you know, doesn't look like anything to me.
Yeah.
Probably with the default lines,
right,
or, you know, if they would ask questions and say, like, that's a rhetorical question. Like, they would just, like, have ending points, you know, a lot of dead ends to choose your own adventure.
So what were the complaints?
I think one of the complaints was that most of the attendees outside wearing the black hat, white hat, they were wearing normal clothes, which took you out of it.
Ah, right. So
at least
the speakeasy, you have to be in costume. If
yes,
you show up out of costume, they make you rent one.
That's right. So this experience actually is better when I was reading the descriptions than when watching the videos. The videos were fun to watch because you could see some of the interactions. But everyone, you could tell, was just like a South By. You know, people had badges on.
It's not, and that's just not a matter of playing the part. It's a matter of creating the illusion for everybody.
Exactly.
Because it's hard to tell who's an actor and who's not
exactly,
when everyone's in costume.
That's right.
Would you pay for a real Westworld, not real, but a Westworld immersive experience?
Totally.
where you got to dress up, and there's a smaller amount of people, sort of like the speakeasy that we did earlier this year.
I mean, I think that's a really good point. HBO, I mean, this isn't their business, but if they had set this up as a, you have to come up in cowboy garb, you know, Western apparel, and you're not playing Westworld as the guests in the TV show do, you know, going out on adventures. It's not Red Dead Redemption, but you're playing it as an immersive theater experience in the TV show Westworld world, where the mystery is about what Delos is doing and the rogue robots. That would be amazing.
HBO doesn't have to do it. They just have to license out the story to somebody else to do it.
Sure. Yeah.
I think that would be amazing.
That'd be really cool. You know, put in some escape room gimmicks in there, and you got yourself a location-based experience.
With all the Westworld interactive stuff, did they actually talk about the show? Because it has been forever.
They did. The show's coming out, second season's coming out next month, and the co-creators, showrunners had a big panel talking about lessons learned from season one. Makes me want to rewatch season one. I hear the 4K HDR Blu-ray is supposed to be very good also. And they totally acknowledge that a lot of the plot twists and were theorized by fans on internet communities and picked up by mainstream media. And that, knowing that, like they said basically every plot twist had a Reddit thread at some point.
Before. Are they saying that they adopted them from Reddit?
No. Okay. They had written out and filmed the home season.
Ah.
But they're saying that one of the benefits or you can look at it two ways. One of the pros and cons or of doing a HBO style show and not a Netflix dump it all at once binge show.
Right.
They have it week to week is that people are more engaged like they were, you know, with when Lost came out, but you give time for theories to come out.
Yeah.
And because of the way information spreads, it's not like, like forums were 10 years ago. Now a writer for Variety or Hollywood Reporter is going to pick up on those theories and get that theory, which may be how the plot twist happens, out into, you know, newsstands, literally, which may spoil the show.
But there's also so much noise out there that that signal gets lost. I mean, that Game of Thrones theory about lineage that came true in the past season.
Well, I think fans
was out there for like 3 or 4 years.
Right. And I think... And even things like Red Wedding, right? Like spoilers, and that's a different scenario where
there's
source material, and people are happy that the theory was proved right because they saw the seeds of it in the very beginning, and it wasn't put out to be necessarily a major plot twist. It's interesting for someone like Joey who watched Westworld, and he's very spoiler averse. You know, the big reveal came as a big surprise. And that allows you to then rewatch a show in a different, completely different light when you rewatch it. If you have the theory in mind as you're watching a show, then you're kind of picking things apart and you're letting like little nuances actually reinforce the theory or disprove it. And so you're not watching the show necessarily as the showrunners intended. But the point being that for season two, they knowing that theories are probably going to be out there, they're saying that they're going to do something a little bit different, and they're not saying exactly how, maybe a little bit even controversial, to take those theories into account. So
how can they do that?
Maybe they're filming alternate endings. Maybe they're filming a lot of extra scenes. Maybe they're going to plant theories themselves. A lot of interesting options. I think they're toying with this meta conversation about the show.
So for those Hollywood reporters that listen to this podcast, what are you hoping for? What are your theories about season two?
I have no idea.
Samurai world?
I mean, I think that's going to definitely be there. I don't think we're going to go beyond the scope of the park, whatever, or parks.
You don't think it's real world? We don't get
into real world. I don't think we get into real world. Yeah.
That's like, was that Jurassic Park 2?
That was Jurassic Park 2. Yeah. There you go. I'll tag this in tech news, but it is a little bit of a tie-in to what happened at South By. A surprise appearance at the Westworld panel was Elon Musk. And I guess he's a fan of the show. He's friends with the showrunners, Jonathan Nolan, Lisa Joy. And what he talked about there was not necessarily about the show, but they said the show is so dystopian that they wanted something utopian or something optimistic to end their panel. And so Elon gave Jonathan Nolan footage lots of footage they had filmed from the Falcon Heavy test, and Jonathan Nolan cut together a inspirational video set to David Bowie about the launch.
Oh, wow.
And they called it the first chapter, or the next chapter in this, you know, the human story. But it's a really nice video.
So that's out? You can watch it?
Yeah, you can watch it on YouTube.
You can watch it. I think there's a couple important things that came out regarding that footage. We got to see the center core blow up.
Yes, you get to see it crash into the barge.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it is spectacular.
Even for that half a second, you see it. Yeah.
Where is the camera located?
It's on the barge, and the camera basically gets wiped out.
Yeah.
From the explosion in the sea. It's like a very violent explosion. I guess that's what happens when a rocket hits a fluid like water, which essentially acts like cement at those speeds. The other thing is he actually talked about BFR, the big fucking rocket that's going to be propelling them towards Mars, and how excited he was about all of that stuff. And this comes in contrast with, I think Jeff Bezos put out video of some Blue Origin rocket tests with liquefied natural gas. So I think the space race heating up. Billionaire space race.
Who will be the first to build their colony on Mars? Let's go back to dystopian news. So Silicon Valley, lots of startups, lots of bizarre ideas, some of them laughable, you know, when you're talking about like $400 juicers. But you can make a lot of money by having a crazy idea. And there are a bunch of startup incubators that where these ideas get developed. And one idea that, I don't know, I don't even know how to describe it. It's called Nectome. And the company's pitch is they want to put your brain in stasis. Mm-hmm. So you can potentially have all the information in your brain scanned and uploaded to some computer in the future. That technology isn't what they're developing, and they don't have it yet.
Okay.
But they believe that's in the future, that may be possible. They, for a handsome fee, you can have your brain basically embalmed.
Just the brain.
Just the brain.
Not my head.
Not your head.
So this is not like cryogenics.
No.
This is just...
And there are existing companies that do that kind of cryogenics. I think like Ted Williams' body and head is stored somewhere in a freezer in Arizona or something.
If you think cryogenics is kind of fraudulent, let's just keep going with this story.
All right.
Okay.
But the catch is, like you said, it's just your brain.
Yep.
And so for this service to work, they got to kill you first.
Or I have to die.
Oh, you have to die. It's 100% fatal.
Yes. Yes. You know.
Not guaranteed success either. So the idea is that they want to market this toward people who potentially have terminal illnesses. Mm-hmm. And because in a state like California, there are legal avenues for euthanasia.
So you're saying I can't die of natural causes and then have this done?
I'm not sure about that, because the first test they were waiting for like someone who had passed and then donated their body to science, or they could acquire the body.
Yeah.
And they experimented with that. Like some woman had died. They bought the body very soon after she died and then tried this embalming process on it to prove that they could preserve a brain. So there's no even guarantee.
Wait, they did that?
They did that. Yeah.
Okay. And they say they were successful?
They say they're successful. So they can preserve it in a way that they won't damage the cells or the way the cells are connected. Mm-hmm. That's one of the fears of cryogenics, is because when you freeze the brain, the water turning to ice could damage the cells.
And what's the doctor's name? Frankenstein?
If it makes you feel better, they are taking pre-orders.
Money refundable.
It's a deposit of $10,000. There is some legit stuff happening behind the scenes, not to just, you know, shit on this. I mean, it's worth shitting on. But they are working with Ed Boyden, who is a researcher at MIT. He's been on my science podcast before. He's a brilliant guy that's really studying how neurons sort of fire at the most basic level. And they supposedly are collaborating with him on how this preservation technique could actually maintain connections over time.
How many of those can, I mean, so it's the brain that they embalm, that they preserve, they're saying that brain is dead. it's brain dead. It's not gonna, they're not gonna kickstart it. It's not gonna be like jolting that brain back into consciousness sometime in the future. What they're promising is that they'll embalm it and store it. And at some point in the future, they hope the scanning technology or the image analysis technology mm-hmm. will be strong enough that they can then map out all the cells and all the neurons and all the 8,000 connections that each neuron has with other neurons mm-hmm. and then digitize that so that the information in your brain and whatever you understand to be consciousness will then be preserved and mm-hmm. activated again.
Just imagine merging singularity with IoT so I could just be on demand on a device.
I mean, this is kind of my dream. I want to be digitized.
No, thank you.
I would like that. I want to make sure that my digitized self knows that it's digitized and that it doesn't think it's alive.
What about the upsell? Can you get your brain embalmed, $10,000 base fee or whatever it is to get your brain embalmed, but you want to be high on the list to get reactivated?
No. No, I want to be low.
you don't want to be first gen. You don't know early adopter.
No.
Because they probably have to destroy the brain.
Yeah.
Like physically destroy it to get all that, to pick it apart.
Yeah.
But what if you're too low on the list and you're not taking, you want like the nice storage unit.
You want the the Goldilocks zone.
You want like the fancy backup batteries, right? Like you want extra custodian care. You don't want to be thrown in a locker with the other brains, right? But you also don't want to be uploaded too early.
Is it $10,000 flat? Like that's the total fee?
That's the deposit.
No, but what's the total fee? Is there an annual fee?
They don't know yet.
All right.
Wait, you don't like the sound of that? Give us $10,000.
Even funeral plots, even grave plots, you only get it for like 100 years.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Well. Then you have to start paying a storage fee per month.
Yeah.
That's where they get you. It's a subscription
service. It's a subscription service. Don't worry. It's going to be built in your Amazon Prime subscription. As long as your family is still subscribed to Amazon Prime, your brain's going to be kept in that box.
And then
won't throw it away.
Once I'm digitized, like, is there a rental fee for that? Because I'm using up cycles, kicking up RAM. And
that's right.
I mean, I've moved in somewhere.
You only get so many free plays before the premium has to kick
no,
in.
No, no.
Free to live.
Your memories and will be turned to assets. So people will be able to buy your experiences, and that's going to help pay for your storage.
You want to remember your wedding day? Yeah. Well, with our free plan, you can remember the first 10 guests. Yeah.
For the next hour, if you pay $5, you'll remember everybody.
So Black Mirror season 5, guys.
Wow.
All right, back to some product news. Apple did something interesting. They bought a company that's been around for a while. A subscription-based service, a media company called Texture. Now, if you're not familiar with the name Texture, you might know the name Next Issue, I think it was called. It was like Netflix or Spotify for magazines.
So any magazine for a subscription fee?
They work with publishers.
Okay.
And I think it was kind of started when the iPad first came out. So a bunch of magazine publishers and media publishers bought into this idea and digitized, you know, whether it's PDFs or whatever, of their magazines, and they had some type of app-based reading experience. And they say they have plenty of subscribers. They rebrand themselves as Texture, and now Apple's bought them. What do you think they'll do with it?
I'm sort of stuck here because this idea of magazine seems ancient to me in a weird way. Mm. And, like, how does that fit into content outside of what they've done with Apple News? Has Apple News been considered like such a success that they want to broaden it out, kind of flatten it to have much more content rich areas beyond Apple News? I'm not in that universe. Apple News really useful?
I don't find it very useful. Not as useful for news as something like Twitter.
Well, that's true for current news. I do like to sometimes review Apple News at the end of the day because it's a nice little consolidation of a lot of interesting headlines. I think this would be more interesting for the archive than for current issues. You know, if you could actually access the history, all of Wired,
mm-hmm.
that would be interesting, especially for the ads half the time.
Well, they also acquired a service called BookLamp, which was like, you know, like Prime Books, you know, like a subscription service for like a library service, essentially. So maybe this is their way to move into the value add. I mean, maybe they know more about how people are using iPads than we are normally expecting. Maybe people on iPads want to be reading books and magazines, and Apple knows this because they have the data, and they can tie this into some type of subscription service, including their music subscription service, so that you get more value out of the iPad you're buying.
I mean, this service only had, according to Ars Technica, hundreds of thousands of subscribers. I can't imagine they paid a huge sum for this. Apple is...
You think they bought the technology? I had a platform, or is it relationships with the publishers?
I think this is not a big deal. I think this is a small team in Apple who made a purchase, and maybe something will come of it, maybe it won't. Apple is almost a $1 trillion company now.
Well, they say they make very strategic purchases. They don't buy companies...
Purchases, yeah.
They don't buy big companies that are mature. They buy budding companies that they think they can do something with.
Yeah, I know. I'm sure they're going to try to do something with it. I don't expect it to make a huge impact on their bottom line.
I mean, they're also making big investments, as they announced last year, into original content, and we still haven't really seen the fruits of that. Eddie Q did an appearance at South By where he talked about, you know, they're after quality and not quantity of content, and we're all very curious of what is Apple's House of Cards, what is Apple's Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And we don't know. One of the benefits is that they don't have to make content like Google or Facebook or YouTube is making content in terms of being advertiser based. They are in the business of selling hardware and increasingly in subscription services. So it can be more be like a Netflix or HBO probably like model where they're buying big ideas and putting big bucks behind it. So we'll see. They also did a light mention about AR, and it's funny. Apple talks a lot about AR these days, but the AR they talk about is all in the context of the type of AR that you use through your phone.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's where their hardware is.
Is right now, exactly.
Well, that's what you can
but they,
do
they
now.
They do so. They talk so big, and like AR, this type of AR is, or AR in general is going to be ubiquitous, and you're gonna use it every day.
Because they've seen the future.
I don't really see. I mean, they can't be talking about you holding your phone up. No, they're coyly talking about the glasses without talking about the glasses.
That's all it is.
Yeah, and they've been asked about it too. Tell us about the glasses. Well, I'm not at liberty to talk about future products.
Johnny Ive has a pair of glasses that he's made, and it's awesome.
It looks terrible.
No, why would you say that? It's going to look good. That's like one thing Apple does consistently well.
I don't think you can make glasses with those panels that look good.
We'll see.
You can make them look better than the other ones.
Yeah.
But good as in you're going to be wearing them on the street today? No.
No.
No. I don't think that's anytime soon. They have to change. They have to find, like, every AR company has to find a way to make wearing some type of headgear acceptable, maybe in your home first, then out in the public. And, you know, maybe that's why they bought Beats.
What?
Because, you know, Beats had a huge success is in marketing, right? By paying celebrities to wear their headphones and musicians and athletes to talk about the brand, talk it up. They changed what was acceptable in culture, and wearing the headphones with the Beats logo was a status symbol.
Not even paying them often, like just Iovine, like going into a video shoot saying, "We need a day with people wearing the headphones."
And yeah,
it just happens.
Yep. So, you know, maybe that marketing strength and that understanding of how do you change what's socially acceptable and what people want and covet, because that's a huge part of their brand. Is maybe that's how they'll get people wearing glasses in the future. They have to look good enough, I think.
Well, and they have to be useful enough.
Yes. So I think even if you had the killer app that you, me, and the people in this room and everyone out here listening would think is a system seller and it will change the way that we interact with the world, the way that smartphones did, that's not a guarantee that people will socially accept it.
Well, what's the speaker? HomePod? Is that the Apple speaker? Like, by all accounts, those are not selling well.
Mm-hmm.
And those have the utility.
Like, they have the best sounding speakers for that size.
Exactly.
And they made the bet on quality.
but they lack a utility that is compelling, which, you know,
you need both
compared to the Amazon product or even the Google product. I don't know if you've come to terms with that or not, but I just don't think it compares. I don't think Siri can compare yet.
Can't wait to see what they do. All right, moving on. We talked about Amazon Prime and Prime Now and the new relationship with Whole Foods last week. Well,
oh, I did that, by the way.
Oh, you did? You did?
I got Prime Now delivery from Whole Foods.
$35?
Like 2 days ago.
You had a minimum of $35 order.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is easy to do at Whole Foods.
Now, sure. They have lowered the prices.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm saying, when's the last time you went into a grocery store or got groceries and didn't come out with $35?
It's a real investment.
So I used Instacart for a long time, which is a startup in many cities that does this with many different stores. I have to admit that this is a better experience than Instacart.
What aspect?
Two things. Like, one, they automatically add a tip in when it comes to Prime Now, which I like that because it takes away an element, another piece of work that I have to do.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't like having to do. And then they package the food really well. Like, I bought ice cream to kind of test it out. Because you figure it'll melt. But they had a special cooler pocket for the ice cream, and it came still frozen.
But they take the pocket back with them, or?
They don't.
Oh.
So it felt a little wasteful.
Oh, you're supposed to throw it away.
Well, I recycled it, but yeah.
Interesting.
I mean, it's basically this, like, you know, small cooler kind of padded thing.
Hmm.
But I like that little touch to it because I thought that was a nice test. I ordered some stuff from like a deli counter. It was a really wonderful experience. I'm definitely going to try it again.
What was the time frame like?
I ordered in a 2-hour window
mm-hmm.
for the free delivery. If you want a 1-hour window, it's like $5 or something.
Hmm.
And I placed an order at noon and had my stuff by 3:30.
All right. That's longer than the 2-hour window they promised.
No. I placed an order in a 2-hour window when I knew it would be home.
Oh, got it.
So Amazon's Whole Foods delivery service is currently available, I believe, in Atlanta and San Francisco, right? Walmart has a grocery delivery service as well that's available in, I think, 8 cities. I'm not sure which ones they are, but they just announced that they will be expanding, not to be outdone by Amazon, to 100 cities. All across the United States. Holy moly. Mm-hmm. I don't buy groceries from Walmart, but I assume a lot of people do.
Well, and basically it's the same idea as Prime Now. I mean, Prime Now uses a tip feature,
mm-hmm.
and it's basically like 10% of whatever your order is, and it turns into the tip, and Walmart is doing a flat $10.
10%?
Not 10%. Is it? It's like something in that ballpark, though. Right. But Walmart's doing a flat $9.95 per order fee.
Okay.
On top of the $30 minimum. But if you're spending like $100 on groceries, which isn't abnormal to do, that's basically like 10%.
Yeah, it's like, what's your time worth?
Going back to AR, breaking news, saw a video on Twitter.
Oh my.
I want to share this in the show notes.
Mm-hmm.
This is super cool. A fan of Street Fighter 2, this is just a fan-made thing, has rebuilt Street Fighter in Unity with AR kit. And the video is awesome. You got to watch this video.
Wait.
They are playing Street Fighter on their tables in AR or life size.
You're not playing Street Fighter.
They're playing Street Fighter.
So they're 3D models. Like, he's really done a lot of work on this.
Yeah.
Okay. How do you get it?
I don't know. You still got to use touchscreen controls.
Oh, this looks horrible.
The controls look horrible.
Yeah.
The animations look awesome. There's even a mode where they put a virtual car, in a parking spot, and then Ken breaks the car down, like in Street Fighter.
You don't believe that this is done without any After Effects?
Oh, I think this is a screen capture from a phone.
I don't know. What's the point, man? Come on, this is a tech demo.
I love it.
Would you actually play this outside in the real world?
If it was glasses, yes.
If it was glasses.
I'd want to hold the phone up.
Yeah.
Who wants to hold the phone up?
I mean, you're holding the phone up to play the game when you're on on the subway.
But then your head's looking down. You're in an ergonomically comfortable position. Your phone's rested in your hands on your legs, not held up in the air.
this totally looks cool. I would never play this as is. I would try
still
it.
Still looking for that killer app for AR. All right, this isn't it.
Ooh, this sounds good. What's YouTube will add information from Wikipedia to videos about conspiracy reports, The Verge.
So Susan Wojcicki at South By announced that for videos on that are kind of conspiracy type videos, like the moon landing was a hoax, they're going to add one of those doopley-doos, those boxes.
Those cards.
Draw in information from Wikipedia to provide a differing point of view.
On top of the video?
Like below the video, below in the one video. Of those boxes.
So they won't they won't censor the video, but their algorithms will target things that they see as disingenuous or misleading. And so, because, and this comes out of the recent reports that their algorithm promotes these videos because people watch them.
Right.
And not just promotes videos to people watching other conspiratorial videos. Like if you watch like an Apollo 11 landing video, there is a chance you'll be shown a conspiracy video about the moon landing being fake.
People manipulating the algorithm. Yeah.
But so this seems like a good thing on the surface, right?
Sure.
Offering a differing viewpoint on the video provide context to things. I think it's kind of bullshit.
How many people are going to be watching the conspiracy video and then see this little note below it saying, you should reconsider believing this video because here's some other facts that you should think about.
I think the people who believe in conspiracy theories are that's conspiracy.
That's part of the problem.
Yes.
See, because it's not, I think it goes beyond that. I think if this was pre-click, if this was this, I think it makes a difference. Like if you're doing a Google search and it
pre-click?
Comes up.
So before the video, it doesn't
before
autoplay.
Before the video plays, if something comes up and says this video.
Is that the case though?
No, that's not what YouTube's doing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
If that was the case, that would actually be interesting because then you're giving the user a choice. Now you're just like, oh, we presented them the information. We showed both sides. That's not how both sides isn't really a solution here to anything. This is just a way for YouTube to walk away from the culpability of their algorithm promoting terrible information. Now, all that the algorithm is great if you're watching other things. Like I've discovered a lot of cool things using the algorithm, especially in making, but I think this is just some BS move. And for the people that are complaining like, oh, Wikipedia can be hacked, like fine.
So what's the solution?
I
mean, you don't think they should censor the videos and take them down, right? So what is the solution here?
I think the solution that's hard is for them to really look at that algorithm and screen out recommendations of content that is, I do think some form of censorship is worthy in this case.
Yeah, I don't know. I think we might get to a point where
Not outright censorship. Censorship in the algorithm recommending certain videos.
It's all about the echo chamber. It's just people seeing the content that they have been fed by people in their echo chamber.
But that's not totally true. That doesn't account for the millions upon millions of views that this has got. Yes, we all know there's moon hoaxers out there.
But no, it's not.
But
like,
are there 20 million, which is like, you know, the aggregate of these videos?
Look, there's nobody out there who's open-minded who's going to watch this video and then be convinced that there wasn't a moon landing. I don't think that that's the case. Like, the people who are really into these conspiracy theories, and that's not even a nefarious one. It's more, the political stuff is far more dangerous. And I
think you're painting a black and white view of how of people's minds are already made up before they come to this. And we're using the moon hoax, which is this very black and white, literally black and white situation. But I think there's a lot more nuanced discussions, like in vaccines and other places.
Sure.
Where it'd be easier to see people being convinced of danger when there isn't solid evidence to say there is.
I mean, so maybe a better solution is for the algorithm to make the subsequent video something that, you know, shows the other point of view. What do you think of that?
I don't think they should be recommending. I think they're creating a terrible user experience with this algorithm because it's designed to keep you watching more and more content.
Yeah.
And I understand that's their business model, but I think that has an end negative effect to the end user.
What do you think about vaccines, Norm?
I think they're important. 100%. It's really stupid that YouTube thinks that they can, their systems are set up to flag like hate speech, but not lies.
Yeah, and for YouTube has handled nudity pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy to find explicit content on YouTube because of how actively it's green. And I have a hard time making it work in my mind that they can't apply some of the same systems they put in place for that for stuff like this.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like there's the whole issue with Facebook and their political ads that they ran in the last election and how that a lot of that should have been screened, and that we're going to get to a point where companies have prioritized free speech and the ability to have any kind of content out there. And we're going to get to a point where that there's a price for that, that maybe wasn't initially evident, or we thought maybe the good would rise to the top. And these point of views can exist, and we're not going to realize the consequences.
I think these companies have sold us a vision that free speech is the value of their organizations, Twitter, Facebook,
right.
Google. And I think at the end of the day, their real value is keeping users on the platform as long as possible. I think that trumps that value of free speech.
I think you're right. I do think that that's certainly true, and that is their financial motivation. That's there, right? I mean, that is unquestionably something that's in their best benefit. But, I mean, maybe they also think that the good will rise to the top. Maybe that there is a side of them that thinks that both can exist. I don't know.
I think they absolve themselves of having to make a decision of what's good by trusting the algorithms, which they program.
That's probably true.
And you know, if you think of like Google search results, it's not always the best result that's at the top. It's just the one that people click the most. And how do you get to the one that click the most? Well, people are able to manipulate those in certain ways.
Well, speaking of algorithms that they have produced, there's a new synthesizer available that you can get on GitHub that is powered by a Google algorithm. It is called the NSynth, and it stands for Neural Network Synthesizer. And it's interesting because what it does is it creates sounds based on other sounds. So they've used a neural network to learn what sounds sound like, and then it will combine them in a way that's more than just blending. So you can give it anything you want. You can give it a baby crying and a flugelhorn, and it will. And then you can have a slider that goes between the two, and you can get any combination that you want. And apparently it's like it was insanely difficult to do this algorithm. They're very proud of it. So they passed on the tech to another like engineering lab within Google, and they made this synthesizer that you can feed four sounds into, and then using a touchpad, you can blend any of those four sounds together in a way that creates sound. So it doesn't make music. Like there have been experiments with making music. Like the computer listens to pop music and it says, I know how to do that. This is not that. This is how to make an instrument.
Does it learn also over time? Like, does it get better?
No. Like, the sounds, I think, are what you get. Maybe they're improving the algorithm over time. Maybe that will improve. But what you get when you make these sounds is what you get. It's cool because they've released this synthesizer for free, and it's all based on free software. That's what I mean, the hardware.
The hardware is free?
No, it's not free, but the plans are free.
Ah.
So you go on GitHub, you get the laser cut for the frame, you get the 3D STLs for the knobs, and then you get all the schematics and the bill of materials.
Hmm. I want to see what it sounds like.
You order all the parts. Well, there's videos of it. Here, I can play you a little bit of what it sounds like. Let's see here. I can go to the middle of this. So they're combining sitar, marimba, electric piano, and clean bass, and then they can move around that.
Interesting.
I mean, if you're Skrillex, it is interesting.
No.
If you want a new sound.
A new sound, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
It's totally interesting. What it needs is, like, interesting creators to make something good with it.
Oh, you don't like?
Not really jamming to it. No, sorry. No. Sound is interesting. You know, speaking, combining AR and sound, something that was shown, also shown at South by Southwest, was AR glasses that don't augment the world with extra visual information, but augment the world with extra audio information. They're from Bose. Bose have developed these prototype glasses that you wear, and in the arms of the glasses are speakers. And also embedded in the glasses are accelerometers and GPS tied to your phone, of course. And as you wander through the world, depending on what direction you're looking at, it recognizes, it knows in its app what may be in front of you, whether it's a restaurant or a monument or some street, and you can tap the glasses to give you extra information about it. So you walk down the street, and I guess you can look at, oh, that restaurant looks interesting. Tap the glasses, and you'll hear its menu and hours.
This I actually really like. This sounds great on some level, especially because there's well-developed audio guides for mm-hmm. cities already sure. that yep. exist. I really like the Detour app, for example. And so to have that programmed into glasses as you're walking around, it's kind of interesting. It's probably never going to be worth the price because it's more on demand. But how many times have you walked down the street being like, I don't know what that building is? Like more, it's
yeah, yeah.
It's not zero.
So I think a lot of it's going to be based on the value of the database it pulls from. So hopefully not just Wikipedia articles. It needs to, I think, you know, cities and locations could benefit from curating your information for audio, which, you know, services like Alexa do. They have to be in short snippets. And also the way it's delivered. Like, I kind of don't want just generic, here's your one sentence fact about it. Right. Like,
yeah, if it tells you a story, or
is it
yeah.
more AI personality based? Like, how do I get to the information that I want most, that's going to be most pertinent? Or do I have to feed some input and ask and use voice activation? At some point, it becomes, you know, Siri or Google Home.
Is it bone conduction too? Because the other thing is if it's loud, that's
I'm not sure.
Suck.
I think there are actual little speakers in there, and I think they designed it so they tap in your ears. I'm not sure exactly what the audio technology is.
The new
is.
Oculus headsets have this kind of mystical audio thing where you can't see the speakers. Like, they're up here, and then they get blasted back and channeled into your ears. Maybe something similar.
But I'm curious if other people are going to be able to hear
right.
what's so, going on. I doubt it.
I doubt other people will hear.
I don't know.
The idea is that
unless they're earbuds.
Unlike sound-canceling headphones, noise-canceling headphones, the idea, just like AR with visual, is about overlaying visual information on top of the visual that you see in the world. Here, it's not about blocking out the sounds of the world. It's about integrating the sounds of the world with these extra sounds. Hmm. There's a lot of opportunity to do some passive, like think about how, you know, like a video AR application can add fancy graphical effects to the world. Like, maybe this is a way for you to get some audio cues about the world as you're navigating it, like directions, you mm-hmm. know, more than just sure. the tap on your wrist for left and right.
I'm thinking about a museum experience that could be really augmented.
Well, the museum experience could be expanded to the world.
I mean, I'm thinking more like passive engagement. Mm-hmm. So even in museum experience, it's less about looking at a painting and then hearing five sentences of description about it. It's maybe music subtly playing yeah. and changing depending on what room I'm in to fit the theme of the room.
On both arms are a proprietary type of speaker that emits surprisingly loud and clear sound to the wearer's ears, but not to the world around them.
Sounds like what Oculus
is using.
Why is
that a description of every audio device? Surprisingly.
You could hear Oculus's, though, from the outside. Yeah, so yeah. I wonder how accurate that is. I had this idea 10 years ago that, you know, when smartphones were finally becoming a thing, that it would be a cool app to be able to go anywhere you want in any city and record your own narration. And then that becomes a part of this app anyone else can listen to. I think that would be a very interesting way to crowdsource this kind of you know, content, where you go to any major city and people have upvoted the best descriptions of the area you're in, and you get to listen to somebody's description of it. Crowdsource it. That's the way to do it.
Hmm. And I can just see the Gizmodo article. Mm. We went on a tour of the most downvoted...
Exactly.
Right.
Tour audio.
Right. Yeah, I think curation's probably a little better. I mean, look at like Atlas Obscura. Like, partner with an experience, source of information.
I clearly have more faith in the algorithm than either of you.
I do not have any faith in the algorithm. I have faith in people's ability to manipulate it.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about some robots.
All right.
This is kind of cool. In Japan, there's a company now selling basically robot wolves that are kind of like scarecrows, except they're robot wolves.
What do wolves ward off?
Good question.
Villagers.
Villagers.
For $5,000, they've run a test of this. These super, it's called a super monster wolf. It looks terrifying. And
wait, is this it wearing a mask, or is this it?
That's the face. That is the face of this super robot wolf. The Japan's agricultural cooperative have done trial runs, and they say it significantly reduced the number of crops that are lost to wild boars.
Wild boars. What kind of noises do they do scare off wild boars? Like sound of hunters?
They have a variety of sounds. Gunfire, howls, and even human screams. This sounds like the most terrifying robot ever.
There's a pack of robot wolves imitating human screams going around. That sounds great.
That's great.
It also sounds like something that Japan would make.
Wow,
so,
$5,000.
It's not bad. Not bad.
Really?
You have eye sensors on Dude, them? Motion sensors?
I'll sell it for four.
It's solar powered?
Oh, see, that's where they get you, solar power.
They're green.
We could build this for less.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I don't think it moves. I think it just like is a scarecrow. And
even better.
Oh,
there.
We could build that yeah. for much less than $5,000.
Do you think it needs to move in order to really convince the boars?
I mean, you need some type of animatronics. The head needs to like shake wildly as it's yeah. making a human scream.
Because all this must have then is a motion.
Kill me! I've turned into a wolf!
Oh my God. I want to see video of this.
Yeah.
There's
video.
I'm good. I don't need to see video.
Go to YouTube. You can find the video.
Okay.
Okay. Couple quick hits before we move on. Mm-hmm. We talked about cars last week and advanced headlights, and you guys were not hot with the idea of projection mapping headlights onto the street.
Yeah.
So how about a different type of technology? Audi has paired with Washington, D.C. for their cars to now have sensors that pair with streetlights so that you get a countdown timer in your car for when the streetlight will turn green.
Really?
Good idea, bad idea?
I think a great idea. So
great
I already
idea?
I
wow.
Hear me out.
Okay.
The pedestrian signs that have the countdown in them.
People are looking at those anyway.
People are using those as the traffic light countdown. Why not just integrate that into the car?
Mario Kart, do I hit accelerate when it turns yellow to get extra boost?
Just after two. You hit I think here the other benefit is that distracted driving is just a reality. People are using their phones and cars, whether we like it or not. And this has a potential of being a way to minimize that. Because now you have a countdown of how much of the time before the light turns green.
Do you get an audible alert as well?
I think it's just a visual countdown.
It should go beep, beep, beep.
No. There's too many audio alerts in cars.
I think that this is a good thing just so that autonomous cars will get the signal and be more aware of what's going on.
Yes, I think it's the visual information is a stopgap piece of technology that will become irrelevant anyway in 10 years when the cars are autonomous. Now, if you're in the back of a stoplight, right, and you're like five cars back, do you get this information or do you only get it if you're the first car?
How is it communicated?
It's a wireless.
Then you get it.
Yeah, you get it. Yeah, it doesn't really benefit you because you got to wait for the other cars anyway.
You probably are the only one who has it in your dashboard. No one else is going to have this.
Right, so like you want that first car. Go faster. Don't you realize it's going to turn green in 3 seconds?
Yep.
Get ready. Yeah, I think it's going to just make people more agitated. Be more patient. Come on.
That's what knowledge does.
Be more patient. Okay, speaking of more cars, GM is starting potentially a peer-to-peer car sharing service. How's this
going
to work?
It's supposedly like Airbnb. It's going to be built off of their Maven platform, which I haven't used Maven, which is their essentially like Zipcar type, you know, on-demand car service. But the reviews on it have been poor. But this idea of, I'm going to rent out my car for, you know, a week or something else to travelers, I initially was really opposed to that. Like cars are really super personal space. But people are doing this with their houses.
Well, they're doing it with
even more personal space.
That's true. Yeah, yeah.
Sure.
And isn't this just getting people accustomed to the idea of sharing their cars once they become autonomous anyway? Like, that's my big
concern.
I don't want to share, like, a fancy, you know, Elon says you'll be able to, you know, set your Tesla Model 3 in Uber mode while you shop for groceries and make money while as opposed to parking. But if you spent $50,000 on a car, you're probably not excited about the idea of putting other people in there, too.
Or you might be excited about making some of that money back.
True. So this is going to slowly get the social acceptability up there.
I mean, they have to work out all the insurance mechanics and all that kind of funky stuff with it. But I like this idea. I mean, 20 years ago, when people were still smoking in cars, or if that was when that was more prevalent, I would be grossed out by this. So now I'm kind of into it.
How do they get it? Do they come to your house? Do you meet them? You can't.
They haven't
meet
announced
them.
All of that stuff.
All right. Another good idea, bad idea. Jeremy, this might be interesting to you.
Okay.
There's a new cryptocurrency mining rig.
Mm-hmm.
Exciting. And it also doubles, because of its form factor, as a room heater.
Well, yeah. In my experience, mining rigs do double as heaters. So this makes perfect sense.
So
let your heater earn you money.
It's expensive, $3,500.
It doesn't create all its heat just from the graphics cards, though, right? It can't.
It's basically a PC with a big radiator and a wood grain finish on top.
I mean, it's not a bad idea.
You have a funny definition of the word sense.
A mining machine with two graphics cards, that's not going to create enough heat to heat a room.
No. I mean, we've been playing VR.
I think it's a bad idea to generate to build a computer that mm-hmm. then also has a heating element that wants to introduce extra heat in its immediate surrounding. That seems like a bad design for a computer.
Well, I mean, I'm going to assume they got it working right. It's just going to be kind of expensive.
I think that's a bad assumption.
I don't know about that. Well, you guys are...
This falls
no,
under...
No. It's just the...
So cynical this week.
No. Computers aren't built to transform electricity into heat in the most efficient pathway.
Uh-huh.
That's what I'm... That's my complaint
right.
about
so supposedly
this.
That this design improves on that. And it's...
I'm really cold. Mine faster.
Why not make a heater...
Max out those GPUs.
If you make a heater that pays for itself... I mean, the hard part is going to be setting all this up.
$3,500 heater.
Is it a $3,500?
$3,500.
Wow. Yeah. Holy cow.
Maybe you missed that part.
Well, it's going to pay for itself eventually. And I just wonder what the setup's like. And are they taking a cut? I mean, they should be selling this thing at a loss and taking a cut of the profits.
Oh, such a bad idea. Falls, okay.
The wood grain finish on a computer, though. I kind of like that.
All right. Good idea, bad idea. Pi Day. This may not be relevant today as you listen to this. We'll see how soon we get this podcast out. Microsoft is doing some discounts for Pi Day, up to 31%, 31.4% off of some laptops if you're looking for like a new XPS 13, which has been well reviewed. And also some discounts on their mixed reality headsets as well, discounting the price to $314.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean.
And so we enter Elon's shower.
All right, one bit of news from Elon's shower thoughts. Comedy?
Yeah, go figure, right? So apparently Elon Musk has poached staff of The Onion. Like, I don't even know how you get these guys to listen to what your pitch is. Because The Onion is notoriously, like, insular. They don't take outside writers. They are a family. So Elon is working on a project that has to do with comedy, and he's gotten the best of the best. He's hired off numerous people from The Onion.
This sounds like an Onion headline, by the way.
Yeah.
Elon Musk hires Onion writers for a comedy project.
Elon has joked that, obviously, the next frontier for him is comedy.
Well, he's making all those boring company jokes.
Right.
He needs a new writing staff for his tweets.
But please tell me, actually,
that's a legit shower thought.
Why comedy projects?
No idea. Nobody knows.
He needs new copywriters, better copywriters.
He has the Engadget has quoted him as calling The Onion. You'll be able to find the essential truth of things in The Onion, and I think there's something to be said for that. That their comedy cuts to the core, and he's probably speaks to him.
Look, I know we have a whole like billionaires be crazy vibe going on this week's podcast, yeah. but this is like extra weird.
It's very weird. And aren't you curious?
I'm confused.
More confused than curious.
I don't know. Sounds interesting to me.
Interesting. We'll see what he does with it. All right. That does it for technology news. Before we move on to our next segment, I want to thank the sponsor of this week's episode, and that is Google's Cloud Platform. What can your data tell you? With Google Cloud Platform, use machine learning at scale to build better products. Google Cloud's AI provides modern machine learning services with pre-trained models and a service to generate your own tailored models as well. Their platform is now available as a cloud service to bring unmatched scale and speed to your business applications, and it predicts so your business can thrive. Learn more about Google's Cloud Platform at g.co/getcloudai. Once again, that's g.co/getcloudai.
Now it's time for a moment of science. So just one story this week, because we talked so much about Stephen Hawking off the top. Theranos. Doesn't matter, because that company is going to be gone soon.
Still seeking those infinity gems.
Yeah. I never put that together until just now. Wow.
That's what I heard when you said the word.
My mind is blown.
There you go.
At this moment. Elizabeth Holmes is the one that started this company with the idea of one blood test to rule them all, that it will be a diagnostic that can, with one drop of blood, be able to test for multiple different things much more efficiently. They had a partnership with Walgreens. It was a total house of cards that the results of these tests were widely exaggerated and sort of fell apart under scrutiny. And systematic investigations of their labs found incredible amount of fraud and mishandling of patient information. And this led to the SEC filing a lawsuit, a $700 million lawsuit against Elizabeth Holmes and the president of the company, whose name I'm forgetting at this moment, for perpetuating fraud against investors. And Elizabeth Holmes settled, I don't know about the president, to pay a fine, and she can't be part of a public company's leadership or board for 10 years as part of that settlement.
Wow.
And the SEC filing indicates Theranos engaged in massive, quote unquote, fraud. And this just sort of is an element of, you know, we make fun of startup culture here from time to time. This is what startup culture can enable. This is the downside of that. Because Elizabeth Holmes was like a darling for a long time. I think I've even talked to her about her on this show in a positive light before it became aware how fraudulent that was. We also don't know how much damage this did. Because with Walgreens using that test, there are some doctors giving out information from those tests. And it's very hard to track, you know, what damage that those conversations between doctors and patients, what happened. One other thing, because a listener brought it up in the comments from last week, talking about the 23andMe test that can test the BRCA gene. Mm-hmm. There are definitely some skeptics on whether this is good or not. The listener pointed me to a Popular Science article that questioned the idea of whether you should have this information, because A, there's false positives, B, you're not necessarily an expert on what to do with this information once you get it, and usually you'd have to go through like a genetic counselor and a doctor in order to get this test under normal conditions. So there are definitely skeptics within the medical community. I feel very differently. I'm on the opposite side of that concern, in that I think people should have access to the information as long as there are appropriate safeguards saying this is not a confirmation or a diagnostic test. This may tell you to get further examination. And there's some potential that'll lead to an increase in number of breast cancer tests, but I think the benefits for research to having a larger data set around this in the short term way outweigh any sort of potential false positives from the 23andMe test.
Since it's a short moment of science, I just wanted to throw in one more story from Reddit. It turns out exercise is good for you.
What?
No, this is the third top story of the week.
Yeah. If you're on Our Science, there's a lot of stories like that. They usually float to the top. The actual big story from last week that I didn't cover was a cover story in Science. Not a cover story, but it was a big story in Science magazine about the prevalence of fake news and how it's much more likely to be shared because of how those headlines tap into a desire. So it's people, a combination of people not reading the full story and sharing based off of headline. All these things that make a lot of sense to us, but they actually tracked how fast directly false stories prevailed and how much more quickly they spread, because there was almost like some sort of confirmation bias they're also seeing. People wanted the information in those stories to be true.
Yeah, I think probably the same can be said for the conspiracy theories. Right.
Let's move on to our last segment.
The VR Minute, virtual reality this week.
Okay, well, I'm glad I talked about zero latency at the top, because we have a couple things we also want to talk about, especially with GDC coming up. Next week's GDC, I think Oculus is going to have a booth there. We're hopefully able to play some games, chat with some people. It seems like a perfect place for them to do some announcement with Oculus Go, but who knows? We're well into the first quarter of the year, early 2018. So where is Oculus Go?
And
really?
There's the other thing. Santa Cruz?
Santa Cruz.
That is also supposed to be on.
Yes. Well, Santa Cruz further out, but they only, you know, it was only showed behind closed doors.
Oh, you're hoping to see a release date for Go.
I hope for Go for sure. Yeah. Hopefully they'll have some announcement related to Go, and then for Santa Cruz probably more closed door, or more, maybe even some public demos.
Yep.
Since developers getting those units now for developing.
For Go, what's the most important thing you want to see? Like launch titles?
How walled that garden is, for media and for applications.
It's just a Gear VR. It's going to have all that content. So that content is stuff I just have not seen, and so I'm happy to see it. I don't care. I don't need a big launch title. It's a $200 device. I just want to get it and experience.
I think they should launch with something.
No, I'm
because
sure, I'm
there's
sure
going to be
will.
People that buy this.
But
yeah.
That's not going to compel my decision.
Well, the resolution is higher than the Rift. So if it can do something like big screen pretty well, you know, it can be a good media consumption device.
Wouldn't that be great? Mm-hmm. Is big screen on Gear VR?
I think I don't want to speak for them.
Okay.
I hope it'll be on Go.
Me too.
Yeah.
Just really quick tangent. Did either of you watch the movie that was on big screen last
Stargate
week?
Stargate Origins, non-3D. I was out of town.
I didn't watch it either.
They need something more compelling.
It looks like it does support mobile headsets.
Oh, there we go. All right. Other future product news. Well, Google is in May going to be unveiling some new technology that they're working with LG, and this is supposed to be a wide FOV and high-density display.
Okay.
Now, it doesn't mean it's a new headset. Mm-hmm. It could just be the panel, but the panel is supposed to be a 4.3-inch, 18-megapixel panel. That's a smaller panel size than we've seen in like the 5-inch panels we've typically seen in headsets or the dual panels, but this could be two 4.3-inch panels potentially side-by-side. But 1,443 pixels per inch. Extremely high density.
Yeah.
120 hertz OLED panel from LG.
Yeah, I bet we'll still see this in VR and still want more. I bet we're going to see this and we're going to say, I still see the pixels.
Well, I don't even care. I don't care about seeing the pixels. I think, we want high resolution. I think 90 hertz is plenty fast. Like 120 may look even more smooth, but I think we've hit that point.
Yep.
The next step is going to be better dynamic range, better quality of the pixels.
Sure, but I also really want a wider field of view. So I'm
sure. We want all of these things.
Yeah.
It's tough to do it all at once, but we're talking about resolution potentially of 5,500 by 300. Or three, I mean, sorry, 5,500 by 3,000. 5,000 by 3,000 for a single panel, which is much higher than what you get on the individual panels, the 3.5-inch panels on, like, the Vive Pro.
So Vive Pro is a 2880 by 1600?
Individual panels is 1440 by 1600. So I think the idea is...
And that's like four times the pixels.
Yeah, yeah. On a larger panel, which then accommodates for a larger field of view. I'm curious what the talk is going to be. Is it going to be about, like, you know, the manufacturer of the panels? Is it going to be about how you make content for resolution this high? Is it talking about their special drivers? Like, I like the idea... We got VR because of the commoditization of smartphone displays.
Right.
And that's what helps. Even today, you know, Oculus Go essentially being smartphone displays that can be manufactured at relatively cheap costs. Now we're starting to see VR-made displays that are custom-made for VR with special drivers that don't have to be that wouldn't work on a smartphone that you're going to have to make custom hardware for. And, yeah, it's going to be in the high end. But we need this type of innovation, even though we know it's going to be a premium model, to push this type of technology forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I wonder how long until we see it in the headset.
Years.
You think? Maybe next year.
Well, something that may help with the rendering of graphics on a panel this high density, and we're going to get higher density panels this year with things like the Vive Pro, is a new feature built into Steam VR. Valve announced that Steam VR will have built-in auto either downsampling or super sampling. So it'll take into account the power of your GPU and your system in general, and it will enable super sampling automatically for games and get you better image quality. What do you guys think about it?
That's great. That's great. I mean, the super sampling is... when you render internally at a much higher resolution and then down res.
And helps with anti-aliasing.
It's like the most expensive version of anti-aliasing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's great. I mean, it actually solves a problem for a lot of people in VR.
I like manual control.
Well, I'm sure that this will have that option, don't you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't think it's like mandatory that every you max out your GPU.
Yeah.
Because even when you have super sampling enabled, that doesn't take into account the areas of a game that may have a lot of information, and you may dip your graphics, your frame rate below like 90 frames per second. Sometimes I turn down the graphics and I disable super sampling because I would prefer to have consistent, smoother frame rates than the best image quality at all times. But it's an interesting option. I think it also works the other way. So we'll also downscale if you're running on a lower end GPU.
It doesn't seem like that big of a deal. It almost feels like VR is now inheriting something that you just take for granted with PC gaming. You know, like VR up until now, you've had to run at that resolution. You haven't been able to go into options and select the resolution that you would like to run at.
Yeah, know? I mean, some VR titles let you enable super sampling and to some degrees, but not all. And it is something that, because of how graphics intense VR games have been, we always take for granted that VR, you just have to run it at that native res.
Yeah.
Or lower.
Yeah, I think you're right. They've allowed you to adjust super sampling. I'm not sure they've allowed you to go below, you know, to actually run a lower resolution in order to get that frame rate higher.
I've done it for a couple games.
Really?
Yeah.
Below the native resolution of the display?
Yeah, you render it like 0.8 or 0.75.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, well, then I guess it doesn't seem like that big of a deal.
I think that does it for this episode. Any other bits you guys want to talk about?
Oh, the only other VR thing I want to say is the Isle of Lost Skulls is fucking hard.
Oh, my God.
We have a lot more to talk about the Isle of Lost Skulls.
It's
great. On projections.
And it's hard.
Kishore is talking about the latest Quest from the Rec Room team, which came out a couple weeks ago. And we have given it the old college try numerous times.
It's consumed hours of my evenings for the past several days.
There was definitely points when it's fractured our relationships.
I've ended the evenings on my knees on the floor in a fetal position, almost on the verge of tears.
You know, when you did that last night, it actually showed your character lying on the deck of the ship, like face down. So,
yeah,
I could relate.
Yeah.
We have an outro this week from, I get confused about what's been used. This is from A.T. Kearns called Pickle Book.
Ugh. Hi there, I didn't see you.
Test it.
I'm using a pickle book.
Pickle book.
Pickle book.
No, you're actually using it right now.
I've been using it the whole time.
Unbelievable.
With a twist.
Unbelievable.
Test it.
Pixel book.
That needs a Pickle Rick sticker on it.
It does. All right. See you next week.